Hey Bobby, that's for you. Good afternoon. This is a panel called The Voices of Katrina, featuring survivors from the hurricanes of 2005 who relocated to the state of Nebraska. My name is Tara Papalmenum. I'm from the University of Nebraska Public Policy Center. For those of you who attended the discussion yesterday at the Malone Community Center, you'll know that the Public Policy Center was one of a number of entities here in Nebraska that has been involved in working with survivors who arrived here in September of 2005. My boss, Denise Bulling, who is sitting in the audience by the door, was one of the key individuals here in the state of Nebraska who developed a partnership with Health and Human Services to implement one of 20 to 25 outreach programs that exist in this country. Nebraska's outreach program is called Reaching Out Nebraska, which is based out of Region 6 Behavioral Health Care in Omaha. The project coordinator is also sitting next to the door. That's Pam Ashley. There's also a case management program that is based out of Interchurch Ministries in Nebraska. And the coordinator is Caroline Wallace, who's sitting next to Pam. Raise your hand. Thank you. As part of our project, we've been conducting an evaluation of this statewide outreach initiative. In the course of doing so, we've had an opportunity to meet and work with a number of area survivors, primarily in Omaha, but to a lesser extent here in Lincoln. Through this evaluation and a series of interviews we conducted, I had an opportunity to meet the following individuals sitting on this panel. And as this project continues, we're hoping to link up with more survivors as well. Before we begin really quickly, I just want to briefly recognize the efforts of Professor Patrick Jones from Ethnic Studies and the Department of History. Patrick and his colleagues have coordinated this series of events here at UNL, and we're very happy to be part of that. And also, I just want to recognize that, as some of you may know, there are also Hurricane Rita evacuees here in the state of Nebraska as well. And let's remain cognizant of that. Okay, so I hope you come ready for some conversation, some questions later on as well. I'm going to do is introduce our three panelists, and then we'll take some questions later on. Okay. Sitting to my left is Ms. Naya Gamble. Naya has been here since I think about the fall of last year, and Naya is from Biloxi, Mississippi. Next to Naya is Ms. Latasha Medier. Latasha is the proud mother of one son, originally from New Orleans, Louisiana. She resided in Lincoln for approximately 1 year. She has a master's in health science degree in rehabilitation counseling from Louisiana State University. She's medically retired from the United States Army. She's a certified rehabilitation counselor with the Association of Black Psychologists and works at the Department of Veterans Affairs. And sitting at the end is Mr. Bobby Leonard. Bobby's from New Orleans, Louisiana, and is currently the Executive Director of Katrina Survivors of Nebraska Incorporated. I think all these panelists would be more than happy to take your questions and also communicate with you later and after this program. Let's give a hand of applause and welcome our new friends to the state of Nebraska. Okay. Bobby, I think a lot of people here would like to know what your experiences were like as someone who lived through the first couple weeks of September in the city of New Orleans.
Okay, first of all, I want to say that I'm blessed and thankful to be here. I thank God for the opportunity to sit before you and hope that what we have to say will have meaning to you. And I want to say this is a beautiful campus. This is my first time here. You know, I sit outside for a while before we came inside. You know, I'm really envious of people. I thought about Dillard University, right, my home, and the problems that they're having in now. And, I mean, they're in a lot of trouble. But I tell you, the Lord bless me because he allowed me to see about a foot of snow out there and then the ground. And I tell you, I'm not envious of you for that. You need to come to New Orleans for Christmas. Wear shorts. but I chose to stay and ride out the storm for a very important reason. I have a baby sister. And she didn't want to leave. The rest of my family left and went to Houston. Lived with my sister there, 29 of us. Lived with my sister during the storm. And we all thought that it was going to be a day or two and everything would be back to normal. And so we rode out the storm safely. Thank God that New Orleans wasn't hit like Biloxi in terms of the storm itself. And the morning after the storm, I left my sister's house and went to check out my own. And thank goodness I didn't have a whole lot of damage there. And my house is located on Batanga Street, right at the foot of the Mississippi River Bridge, just a block off St. Charles near Lee Circle. Some of you may be familiar with that. And fortunately, I can stand on Batanga Street and look across St. Charles going north. And a block past St. Charles, you can see the water. It was the edge of the water. But towards the river, there was no water. And Earhart, which was the corner on which I lived, there was no water. And I sit in between the Superdome and the Convention Center, right in the middle. And the first 2 days after the storm, after the water came, actually when I left my sister's house, I gave my nephew, my sister's son, my car to go check out his house. And so, because there were so many limbs down in our area, but we was hoping they could get to his house to check it out. And when I left out of my sister's house, there was no water that morning. And I talked to my sister that afternoon around 1:30, and the water had begun to climb the stairs in her apartment complex. And they were running out as we were talking on the phone. And I mean, the last thing I heard was the water was rising, and it had not gotten to us, so we had not heard anything about water at that point. And as the water came, we got news because all of the people, so many people were coming in. I mean, it was tens of thousands of people just all at one time, just in a panic. And for the first 4 days, I would ride a bike between my apartment, the Superdome, and the Convention Center. And each day that I went, the conditions got worse and worse and worse. The closer you got to each facility, the stronger the stench that permeated from those facilities. To the point where, to get close each day, it would choke you to the point where you would almost vomit. It was just that bad. I mean, and the blessing for me is that I did not know that my own mother was in the Superdome at that time. The first 4 days, my mother was in the Superdome, and I went there each day and couldn't get inside. And then I know she was there because she was in a hospital. And rather than evacuate them out of the city, they evacuated them to the Superdome, and their nurses, whoever, the caretakers, abandoned them. And they left them there. And I did not know this until almost a month after we were here. And I learned where my mother was. And she had been transferred, fortunately, to a little place in Mississippi. And one of my cousins delivered meat to that facility and discovered my mother was there and got her to my sister. And I'm thankful and grateful for that my mother's still all right. Having problems dealing with the trauma, because when she woke up in the hospital and the water was right at the edge of her bed, and they ran out, but it was a horrible thing. And so, I try not to talk about this a whole lot, but I'll give you as much as I can in a short time. From my apartment, I could see the Mississippi River Bridge, and each day there were thousands of people walking across the Mississippi Bridge, and the Mississippi River Bridge is elevated, and people were pushing food cart baskets with all their possessions in it. And the second day, we began to see bodies on the bridge from our second floor balcony. We could see bodies on the bridge, and nobody was going up to pick them up. So the third day, myself and two other people in my community
started going up at the Camp Street entrance to the bridge and walking up the bridge and bringing the bodies down to the foot of the bridge so that the following morning when the police came through, they would pick up the bodies. And we informed them. And then when the Oklahoma National Guard came in, we informed them that there were bodies on the Air Harbor. And they sit there for 2 days before anybody came out, and we gave last rites to those bodies. In the community that I lived in, it was dry. So we had, I could ride up and down all the way to the river, from St. Charles back to the river, of the Irish Channel, a little area. And each day, we would ride by, and you could smell dead bodies in the houses. And the National Guard in our area was the Omaha National Guard, and we would tell them, I mean, Oklahoma National Guard, and we would point out houses to them, and they would tell us that they was animals in those houses. And we started going in and taking out as many of them as we could. I don't know if you've ever smelled death, the decay. A person who's been dead for 3-4 days. But it's something that you never forget. You never forget. And we didn't know who the people were, but we knew they were dead, and we knew that they needed last rites, and we knew that they needed to be identified. And we did what we could to do that. That was a facility right across from where I lived called Bridge House, which was a drug treatment community center type place where a lot of the homeless people came and ate each day, and they had a generator there with walk-in freezers and refrigerators, and one of the stores in the community had donated a lot of meat. You're familiar with Bridge House.
It's like the Open Door Mission.
Yes, similar to the Open Door Mission here. It's just like that. And each day, I knew a lot of those guys there. I would go over and we would prepare hot meals. It was the only hot meals in that area. And each day, we had thousands of people needing food. We had women with babies that didn't have no milk. As I go at the convention center, it was more open than the Superdome. And each day I'd ride through there, you would see more and more dead bodies. On the third day, that was a lady. She had 2 babies in her arms. One child was dead. And she wasn't ready to give it out. And so they came and they told me about it. And we brought her over to Bridge House. And we fed her. And we talked to her. And she held both her children. And that night, we prayed with her, and she gave up her child. And I often think about it, because I don't know what happened to her. The National Guard took her away the next day, and we don't even know her name. We don't know how to check on her. I mean, I saw an elderly couple, a white couple. The gentleman was about 80. And his wife, he was pushing the wife in a wheelchair. I was riding down St. Charles on my bike, and her knees were all skinned up and bleeding because evidently fell out of the wheelchair. And I asked him where he was trying to go. He was trying to make it matter. He had come out of the Superdome because they couldn't stand it. And he was trying to get to matter. And there was just no way, because if he kept going up St. Charles, when he got to Louisiana Avenue, that was water all the way down. And I rode up, and I came back down, and I saw him sitting at a Burger King there. And he was kneeling by his wife. And he had a head in it. He had his head in her lap. And I stopped and I talked to him. And I tried to bring him over to where we were, but he needed to make it to Metairie. He thought that if he made it to Metairie, he had family, and everything would be all right. And that was the last time I seen him. And I'm sorry. And I mean, you people like that, incidents like that, they stay with you. You can't divorce yourself from them. You can't forget them. You can't put a color or a race on them. I live in Omaha, and I was on Dodge one day, driving, and I saw this lady in a wheelchair, and the whole experience of Katrina just fell on me, and I was real blessed that I was able to pull my car over and just collect myself. When I watch the television and I see the destruction, you know, I mean, there's no way for me to sit here and try to tell you what it was like, what I felt,
Thank you, Bobby. And Nah, you had a very different experience, I think, coming up here from Mississippi, I think. Can you talk a little bit about what it's been like in the past year for you?
It's been hard. Have stuff one day and the next day and then not have anything. Thinking about what you're going to do tomorrow or next week or next month. You know, luckily, my mom then was here. I couldn't wait for FEMA to evacuate me out. My family had to come get me.
Yeah, we've heard a lot about your mom, too. I think she's definitely more effective than FEMA and a couple other entities as well. So let's give a hand to Naya's mom.
My experience down there was similar, except for what you seen, we didn't hear anything. All I knew was that for 2 days before the levees broke in New Orleans, there was no help in Biloxi. I mean, people were walking and wondering. I remember going to the American Red Cross when they first got there to get a shot because we had all been in these houses where water was everywhere, full of sewage, to get a tetanus shot, and they turned you away. I remember when George Bush came down and people were falling to his arms asking him for help, and he's pointing them to places to go to. You go to these places and there is no help. There's nothing there. So since I've been here, I've been asked a million times why I didn't leave. We're in the poorest state in the nation. Where's the money going to come from to leave? Where are we going to go? Where are we supposed to go? What was we supposed to do? Half the people don't even have a car that will make it a block, let alone out of town somewhere. So my experience and what he mentioned, the first thing, something I'll never forget, is the smell of death. And same thing he was told, it's animals. Well, it's not animals. Still to this day, a week ago, they still finding bodies. I remember going, it took 2 days to get to my house. My car doors were pressurized shut, so it took me 2 days to get into my car just to be able to hopefully get through to go to my house. And I was able to get through. I lived 5 blocks from the Gulf of Mexico. And when I got to my block, some houses were there, some weren't. The ones that were there, the trees, it was unlivable. It was no way you could live there. There was no water. There was no lights. 6 o'clock curfew, got to be off the street, even though you're trying to get whatever you can get, because it took you all that time to get in there. A gas line, you know, when finally there's some gas that finally come in, you go 5 o'clock in the morning, sit there 6 o'clock in that evening, still no gas. Your whole day is based upon just surviving, making it past that day. You wake up in the morning, you look for food, water, ice, gas. It's insanity. Everybody's house in my family was destroyed. We had one house we could go to. There were there were 15 adults and 29 children in a three-bedroom house. I mean, I remember asking, well, when is FEMA going to evacuate us out? They're trying to get to New Orleans first because New Orleans was so bad. Finally, two and a half, 3 weeks later, my family came and got me. They bought gas cans, everything, to make sure we was able to get back. And what I had when I came here was one tub of whatever it was I could salvage, which I was lucky, because most people didn't even have that. But when I think about that, I was lucky to the fact I had my family was here. And there was people that couldn't go nowhere. They had to live in them houses. They had to live in them houses. Blankets that had been soaked in that seawater for days and days and days, and when the water finally goes away, that's all you have to sleep on. I mean, I've seen the people, the businesses that were left still standing, people standing on the outside of them with guns protecting their property because somebody might have needed some water, some food, even though you might have had insurance to cover that. Rich, poor, black, white, y'all all in the same line. Everybody needing the same thing. That was my experience. But most of all, he spoke of it better than anybody. You'll never forget that smell. That was basically my experience.
And Latasha, you have a health background yourself. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, your perception of how the system has responded, and what is the healthcare situation right now in some of our Gulf communities?
Okay, well, first of all, my experience was a little bit different from the other two because I was one who was fortunate enough to evacuate prior to the storm, and actually it was ironic because I was attending a wedding in San Francisco. And actually, when I turned on the news to check on the weather to return home, there was Katrina. So I could not get back home. And that's, you know, I was basically stranded up there and couldn't find any of my family. My mother-in-law did not speak any English. She was undergoing chemotherapy at the time. And, you know, she was waiting on us to come home to save her, you know, to evacuate her out. So she was one who did, you know, go to the Superdome and had to undergo all of that, you know, madness. She is in her late 70s, and eventually she was evacuated to the Astrodome. And once we relocated her, we brought her up to California. Healthcare in Louisiana right now, that was one of the main reasons why I wanted to come here, you know, to talk. Because I have been back home several times since Katrina, and being that I have a medical background, one of my biggest concerns is PTSD. And I mean, just based on what you've heard today from both of my counterparts up here, it's classic symptoms of PTSD, especially this gentleman. I mean, the nightmares and the things he's seen, the triggers, you know. So my biggest concern is, what type of treatment is going to be available to help him. You know, everyone is everywhere. People have to be separated from their family. I mean, we've all seen the documentaries, the television shows, the news, the media, of mothers crying, please just save my child. Mothers are in one state, the children are in another state. You know, once they're reunited, if they're reunited, what type of therapy is available? As we all know, New Orleans, Biloxi, they're very poor cities. You know, the poverty rate is very, very high there. One of the biggest problems was people could not afford to evacuate. You know, you had a mandatory evacuation, but yet you didn't have means. You did not provide the financial means to evacuate the people who could not afford to evacuate. You know, and to me, that's like an oxymoron. How are you going to have a mandatory evacuation, but yet you're not providing a way for the poor to evacuate? So Charity Hospital was one of the largest, you know, public health care system in the state of Louisiana. And as we all know, it's gone now. So are many of the health care professionals. And there is basically no incentive for them to return. You know, there is no type of, you know, health insurance between the dirty politics. I'm not here to talk politics today, but between the dirty politics that are going on now and the lack of health care, the poverty rate, there are really no incentive for health care professionals to return to Louisiana. So a lot of people are not receiving the proper mental health care that they need, as well as medical care that they need. With Charity Hospital being closed, from what I understand, people are being denied necessary medical treatment. I went to a wedding in June, and just going to a beautician, you know, it's like when people find out that I'm a counseling psychologist, everyone is gathering around me to tell me their problems, you know, it's like a crying session. Everyone wants to talk to someone. You know, it's just a chance, an opportunity to get it out. And, you know, where are the organizations? Where are the organizations to help these people? And that's, you know, that's what I want to speak about. You know, why can we come together? You know, the universities like, you know, UNL, UNO, Creighton, LSU, can we come together to provide, you know, free services or discounted services to help these people? Because, I mean, it's obvious they need help. You know, I mean, can you imagine, everyone in here, can you imagine seeing bodies floating by you? I mean, just close your eyes and just imagine that. You know, can you imagine seeing a casket in a tree? Can you imagine that? No human being should have to live through that. Can you imagine being stuck in 100-degree weather, you know, in water up to your neck for a week with no food or clean water? No one should have to live like that. And for those people who were fortunate enough to live through it, you know, I feel that they need some type of health care, you know, some type of free health care or discounted health care. The city is still a mess. I mean, here we are a year later, and it still looked like a war zone. There are still parts of the city without electricity. I mean, come on, a year later? To me, that's just inexcusable. So, it's just, to me, that's not acceptable. And another thing, okay, I'm going to use myself for it as an example. I consider myself, you know, to be, you know, the average middle class American. And here, when I moved here to Nebraska, I was stranded, you know. All of my bank accounts were off because guess what? All of my banks were in Louisiana. So I could not touch a penny. okay? So I'm stranded with not a penny. So here I have money, but guess what? I had no access to it. Okay, that's one thing people didn't imagine or didn't think about. Okay, and my son and I were in Red Lobster here in the good state of Lincoln, Nebraska. And we had to listen to the couple or the family behind us talking about the people of Louisiana and how those people never had anything to begin with and how they were just trying to scam the taxpayers and how they were just running scams to collect $2,000. What's $2,000? You know, we lost everything we had. What is $2,000? $2,000 cannot bring back family members. $2,000 cannot bring back, you know, your family pictures or everything that you lost. And it really hurt, you know, to hear someone saying something so ignorant. And it really, you know, it hurt, you know, because I had just been through so much. And I was just trying to enjoy a meal with my son because my baby loved shellfish. And, you know, Red Lobster is like the best place to find snow crabs in, you know, that we found here in Nebraska. So to him, it was a taste of home. And to have to endure something like that, to me, was just unacceptable. So, of course, we just packed up and left. But that's the type of thinking that some people had, that everyone from Louisiana was either dirt poor or bad people or trying to run scams or we never had anything. And it's really, you know, it's not like that, you know. And it's just, you know, it was a misperception. In the media, I really blame them. You know, one of the famous things was the looting versus surviving. You know, one thing that the Association of Black Psychologists ran an article about, they had a white family coming out of a store with food, and the article read, you know, family uses survival skills in Louisiana, and then they had a black family coming out with food, and they were looters. So it was all about perception, and I think that, you know, played like a big part in it. And then we had, of course, our famous Mayor Nagin with his, you know, brilliant comments. So, I mean, it was just, I just don't think that the citizens of New Orleans should be penalized for things that the media portray. You know, they have a lot of hardworking people there, and they really need help. And $2,000 is not enough money to replace everything that they lost, and it's not enough money to provide adequate health care. So, like, that is my biggest, you know, thing. I'm here to advocate for proper health care, especially mental health care.
Okay. Just want to throw this out to any one of the panelists here. It's been a year, a little over a year since the hurricane landed. How have things been since then, and how do you feel things are now?
Ooh, okay. Well, over the past year, it's been a learning experience for me. First of all, Nebraska's all right, but it ain't home. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it can help me home, even though I may have to stay here. Since I arrived in Nebraska, I've done as much as I can to support and care for the people who came here with me. I consider that my family now. 167 people from New Orleans was forced from their home, placed on airplanes, never told that destination until they was in the air, almost 45 minutes. Had no idea where Omaha, Nebraska was. The first thought that came to my mind when they said that we was coming to Omaha, Nebraska, and I've traveled quite a bit, but I don't believe that I had ever met a black person They told me that it was from Omaha, Nebraska. Now, I know about the Cornhuskers, and I know you got some fine football players out here. I mean, but I cannot remember for the life of me any black person telling me this was from Omaha, Nebraska. So I prepared myself mentally. Once we arrived in Omaha, initially, the response was tremendous. I mean, the outpouring from the community, I mean, it was totally unexpected, the generosity and the care and the concern of people. When we first got here, and they paraded us to the Civic Center in Omaha, every agency that you could think of was asking us 100,000 questions, and we weren't ready to ask them. We were not prepared to answer any because we were shocked. We had been forced from our homes. And I tell you, I would have preferred staying to help rebuild my city than leave. I mean, I would do everything that I could to stay and rebuild my city. I felt that it was a part of my responsibility as a citizen of New Orleans to stay and help build my city. And that's why I stayed. I mean, if the storm had been bad, I know that we were going to need help. My sister knew this. This is why we didn't want to leave. I mean, we love my city. And so when we arrived here, a number of things happened. First of all, the Red Cross was raising an awful lot of money for the survivors of Katrina. And initially, after we were here for 2 days, they gave us a card, debit card, with $360 on it. And I said, okay, that's a good start. I had no money in my pocket, so $360 was a good deal. And I've seen all the advertisements. I've seen all of the money pouring into the Red Cross. And I knew that we were going to have help coming from that because we had gotten the little debit card with $360 on it. And then after we were here for about a month, FEMA kicked in. $2,000, a whole $2,000. Do anything we wanted to do with it. I bought 3 suits and I was almost broke in. It's one of them. But the promise of help was there. And so it gave us a sense of people caring about it. That perhaps there was, I mean, there was a chance that this thing might turn out for good for us, for a lot of us who needed that. And so we were hopeful. And then, about a month later, FEMA came through again, $2,400. Wow, $4,400. Now, for some people, $4,400 was a whole lot of money. And for a lot of the people that got it, it was a whole lot of money. But we were anticipating a whole lot more because we saw a whole lot of people raising a whole lot of money that they said was for the Katrina survivors. And we were Katrina survivors. So we thought that that money would be coming to us, at least enough of it for us to have a legitimate start. And then we found out that Red Cross, that was a wrap. For FEMA, that was a wrap. Now, there was a number of agencies at the Civic Center that was there to help us. And each one of them had 50, 75 questions that they wanted answered, right then and right there. And we had, I mean, we were just not ready to start dealing with that kind of thing. Everywhere we went in Omaha, there was people, we went to the mall, and people wanted to talk to us about what happened and all that stuff, and we was not ready to answer those questions at that time. So a lot of us that was ad-libbing out here, we did what was natural for us to do. We did a crawfish. We backed up in the little hotel rooms that we was in, and we closed ourselves off from the questions that we didn't want to deal with because those questions were triggers to us. And we didn't want that. We was trying to get away from that experience as best we can, as fast as we can, and begin to deal with healing. And it just didn't happen. The more we withdrew, the more sick we became. The more isolated we became. The more helpless we became. And as the situation continues through December, up until this day, we've not, I mean, there are people who live in the apartment or the tower that I live in, who you may not see but once or twice a year, I mean a month, because they're completely isolated. They don't want to talk to nobody, they don't want to see nobody, they don't want to hear from nobody. Their state of mind, just getting sharp. There's not been anything like post-traumatic stress disorder provided for us, for any of us. I didn't even know that it applied to us until a couple of months ago. But I see that in Florida, where they have hurricanes all the time, for the people of 9/11, 5 years this coming Monday, and a lot of those people are still receiving post-traumatic stress disorder treatments from their experiences, not just their experiences in the towers, but for those who lost loved ones. I saw Oprah a while ago. She had a lady on there who lost her husband in 9/11, who got $5 million. And the program was about how she was spending her money neglecting her daughter, and she needed to let that go and start living her life. And I asked myself, what about us? I see the government can go halfway around the world and evacuate people halfway around the world faster than they can come to New Orleans. Faster. The same government, the same FEMA, the same system. That hurts me. To think about that, to accept that, that hurts me. Because I'm a citizen. I'm supposed to be a part of this country. And I just don't feel like I'm being treated like that. You know, for the people who in Florida who experience hurricanes every year, when they go through that, there's all kinds of people there to aid them. And those who need treatment get it. For us, there's no money available. You was talking about free services. It shouldn't be free. I mean, it really shouldn't. We were forced to come here. We didn't have no choice. We're here now. And we're like, and if I wanted to get up from here and go back to New Orleans, do you know that I can't even get a bus ticket? Not a bus ticket to go back, if there was anything for me to go back to. That's not right. That's not right. So we feel, over this last year, that our hopes have been pumped up, and then they've been cut off from under us. And that's stress. Mm-hmm. I deal with people every day who worry about paying their rent, who worry about putting food on the table, who worry about having $10 or $20 to send to their children that are always across the country that they can't even go visit. I've not seen my children in a year. Over a year. I've not seen my children, who I love. Not because I did anything wrong or they did anything wrong, but because I'm a Katrina survivor. And that doesn't make me feel good. That doesn't make me feel good. Sometimes I regret that I'm a Katrina survivor. I regret it. I think that the people sometimes who died in Katrina are much better off than those of us who survived. In particular, those of us who survived and have been cut off, I'm talking about cut off from our way of life. Because I tell you, I don't find nothing out your clothes to my way of life. I'm not nothing. Not even, what's his name? Red Lobster. Is my turn?
Other thoughts, responses, or panels? And if you don't mind, I'm going to put you on the spot, Linaya. You came here with a young child, too, and you told me it was... in some ways, very difficult for you as a family, and you had a lot of support from your mother. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, I did come with a two-year-old. Well, he was 18 months then.
It was hard. It was hard. I mean, to come here, and it's cold when we got here. It was cold. We didn't have a coat. We didn't have a jacket. The first thing, like you said, when we got here, the first thing we did was American Red Cross gave me a card. And they had 300 and some, no, I think mine was $600 they gave me. And I had to go buy all winter everything because it was so cold. But he's adapted well now. It wasn't so easy in the beginning. It wasn't so easy in the beginning. Not being able to sleep. Staying up, just, it was hard. It was hard. Even though I had my son here with me, I mean, there's still a lot of folks down there that don't even have their kids, you know. My mom's classmates, all found floating down the street, all with their kids. So, I mean, I still feel fortunate. Even though I went through all that stuff, at least I'm here. At least I'm here. Thank God.
Latasha, any thoughts?
Well, I'm here by choice. So, I actually chose to come to Lincoln, and I like it here. I hate your weather. It's too hot in the summer, too cold in the winter, and it's really tough on my allergies, but the people are very friendly. My son, he loves the snow. He tried to take a few snowballs home, ruined my cell phone. But, I mean, it, you know, just some of the things that, I don't know, just some of the things that were really tough was just not being able to find people. You know, that was, I don't know if you guys went through it, but, you know, like when the cell phones went down, going weeks and weeks and weeks not being able to find anyone. You know, just calling and texting and sending messages via the computer and every website you could think of and not being able to find anyone. I think that was like one of the most difficult, you know, experiences that we all went through. But, you know, thank God, everyone in my immediate family is okay. We're just all over the United States right now. We all lost, you know, pretty much everything, and everyone had insurance, but everyone is like really going through the blues with the insurance companies, you know, trying to prove what was blood damage, what was storm damage, you know, that type of thing. But besides that, you know, we're all blessed and we're all alive, so. And we've been pretty lucky this year, no hurricanes.
Well, I hope everyone came ready for a conversation, for some questions. I'd like to encourage a lot of the students here showing up to ask some questions to our panelists. Anyone?
Because the damage was so limited, but also because the response was so overwhelming and immediate that that city was back functioning, you know, purposefully, mm-hmm. and was able to do it within a week or two. Mm-hmm. And so the idea, you know, seeing the reports of, and the pictures and the stories of what New Orleans is still like, mm-hmm. it's just mind-blowing to me, having gone through not something similar in scale, but perhaps similar in disaster, mm-hmm. The differences between those two cities. And I guess my question for the three of you, aside from thank you for coming here and speaking to us and dredging up what it was like to go through, which is so difficult, is to ask if all of us could speak to the people who are controlling the flow of reconstruction money to New Orleans, if we could speak to our representatives to push them to track down what's happening with that money and to insist that something be happening with it. What things should we say? We're all going to write a letter, an email, or a phone call. You know, what primarily, like first and foremost, should be happening in New Orleans that's not because of lack of funds or lack of organization or lack of people expressing their outrage?
I think, first of all, they should stop playing the blame game, because it's like the mayor is blaming the governor is blaming the mayor, and in the meantime, nothing's being done. However, if you look over at Mississippi, they're progressing, they're rebuilding. So, I mean, they're so busy pointing fingers at each other, nothing's being done. I guess, like, to answer your question, there was actually like a documentary on that, like why has nothing been done recently. It was on 2020, if I remember correctly. And if I remember correctly, it was something about the approach that the mayor was using. That's why he was not being granted funding. And I don't think that should have anything to do with it, you know. So what do you think?
What do you think is your comment?
You want to go first?
Mm-hmm, go ahead.
I'll tell you. I read this, I can't watch those documentaries, yeah. But I did read a CNN report, Katrina, the emergency. And according to that document, FEMA, all of the government agencies got together about 3 years ago. And they came down and they did a mock storm evacuation and preparation. And they said that they were prepared to do what had to be done. And I believe that with all my heart and all my soul. I know that the government knows exactly what's going on. And there's no doubt in my mind that what happened was not an accident. I mean, it was not an accident. And this is not the first time this has happened. I mean, the same thing happened in Albany, Georgia. I mean, there are several places where this has happened before, so it was already known. I mean, that amount of water follows the weakest link. The weakest point of the chain is going to break. And the weakest point of the chain was the 17th Street Bridge. And when the 17th Street Bridge is floods, the poor neighborhood. Period. So they do that. The Army Corps of Engineers are an excellent organization. Them people know what they're doing. So they knew where the weak points were in the levee. And they allowed that to break. And the boys that came in, I mean, that boy wasn't there by accident, and nobody ever said anything about it. Nobody ever went and looked for it to see what happened to it or nothing. Nothing. So it was all planned that if we had a Category 4 better storm in New Orleans, this is what's going to happen. Uptown people are going to be spared because the downtown people are going to get the water first. The uptown, the section of town that was dry, the 20% of the town that was dry, was the wealthiest part of the town. I mean, that's just the way it is. That's reality. Whether we want to accept it or not, that's just reality. Who can rewrite and tell? Nobody that don't know.
But
Biloxi was a little different, I guess. Rich folks lived on the beach. The poor folks lived inland. But even though the poor folks did, or the rich people did get their share too, best to believe the poor is always the one that suffered. I mean, who are you supposed to call? Like you said, it's not like they didn't know. It's not like they didn't know that this could happen. Our mandatory evacuation order came Sunday morning at 6 a.m. We knew the hurricane was coming a week ago, but because they kept saying New Orleans and Pensacola and Mobile, we had to wait for ours. 6 o'clock that evening, the hurricane was coming in. So, I mean, our evacuation route, period. There, even though they had some kind of system, so they say, in place, we can't tell that they actually went through and did what they said they were going to do. So to say that there was an evacuation, a well thought of or thought out evacuation route, there was never none.
Can I? I don't know. I, like, with their government, I can remember with Hurricane Ivan, I don't know if you guys remember Ivan, it turned at the last minute. And that was a hurricane that devastated the Alabama, Pensacola area. Mm-hmm. And during Hurricane Ivan, they had a mandatory evacuation for the New Orleans area. And during a mandatory evacuation, they're supposed to have what is called a contraflow system where all roads lead outside of New Orleans. Well, their government decided that Louisiana folks could not use their roads. So they wouldn't let us evacuate, you know, through their roads, which caused like a major, major, major traffic jam. And I live in what's called Slidell, Louisiana. Slidell is like, well, from Slidell to Baton Rouge is equivalent from like Lincoln to Omaha. And that, as you know, that takes like, what, 45 minutes. Well, when I was trying to evacuate for Ivan, it took me 8 hours. Okay, after being in traffic in 100-degree heat for 8 hours, and the storm turned around at the last minute, you know, all of the gas stations were empty. It was hot, people's cars were breaking down, you know, everyone was aggravated, agitated. You know, this is the type of things that we had to deal with. So, of course, when Katrina came, a lot of people did not take it serious. That's why a lot of people did not evacuate, because it was another false alarm, so everyone thought. That's the type of things that the media does not report. You know, oh, another false alarm. Okay, so that's why so many people got caught off guard when Katrina hit. Okay, and, I mean, can you just imagine being in 100-degree heat for that long? And that, you know, it's just, it's aggravating.
Other questions from the audience? Green shirt.
When you got here, you had never, or before you got here, you had never met a black person from Omaha. How has that adjustment been in the last year, feeling that shut off, like that kind of minority just coming into it? How's that adjustment been?
Well, fortunately, as soon as we got to the civic center, I discovered that there were black people. In fact, quite a few of them who have been here quite a while. But I'll tell you, the adjustment. Okay, we were supposed to have gone through a transitional thing. Initially, when we got here, we went to the Civic Center. We were there for 2 days. And then from there to the hotels. We were there for 2 months. And then from there to the public housing. And we were supposed to be there for 3 to 6 months. It's not been a year. The area that we live in Omaha, over the past week, there's been 5 shootings, 3 deaths. We live in a public housing tower. And in that tower, there's despair, there's hopelessness. I mean, we're around people who are constantly depressed. People, I mean, you know, and so there's of course, there's conflict. We live in an area where the average person does not venture away from their home more than 5 blocks. Almost at any given case, rather than have to, unless they have to go to a doctor, you know, to some type of appointment, they very rarely venture outside of their immediate area. I have an evacuee here, he's 75 years old, very mobile at home, still wants to be productive, still capable of doing some things. But he lives in one of these towers. And there's only one bus that comes by his place. There are no stores anywhere near him within walking distance, anywhere near him. So if he has to get a loaf of bread, he has to take the bus and go. It takes him 3 hours to do the round trip to go get a loaf of bread or some milk or something. And he has limitations in that his reading is not, he's not comfortable with it, being able to take one bus to another one. He's afraid of being lost. He doesn't know the city. There's nobody to aid him, to take him around, familiarizing with it. And he told me about 2 months ago that the hardest part of being here is he feels like he's in prison. He feels like he's in prison. That's a tremendous thing for a person to feel, that you're in prison. Because usually when a person is in prison, they're there because they've done something wrong. And so the transition for me, it's not just seeing through my own experience, but to the experience of the people that I'm with, people that I advocate for. And so I think that aside from the financial support, one of the things that would make the transition a lot easier for us is people involvement in our lives.
I have a question.
Sorry.
I have a question.
Okay.
You mind?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, kind of piggyback off the topic. Do you feel that since, you know, New Orleans was such an impoverished area and so many of the public housing areas, you know, were what most would consider like, you know, slum areas, do you think that's why they put the evacuees in what is, sounds to me like the equivalent of projects? I mean, because that's what it sounds like. They put y'all in projects to me.
I mean, that's what they are. It's public housing projects. They're different from the scale that we're accustomed to in Louisiana, but and the high rises here where they're flat in Louisiana, but I mean, that's what they are. And I think that, yes, based on class and race, I mean, that's where we got stuck because, as I was beginning to say, the transition was supposed to be to move us into comfortable housing, which has not occurred. And these were supposed to be housing that the housing authority and HUD owned that we were supposed to be transitioning to, which has not yet happened. I mean, that was the plan that we were told when we got here by Omaha Housing, and that's why we signed up for Omaha Housing, but that has not occurred yet. And, you know, until just a few months ago, the temperature here, as you said, is awful hot. Mm-hmm. We had over 20 evacuees that lived in Omaha Housing that could not afford air conditioners. And I felt that it's important that we have air conditioners because of people's health. You live in these brick towers. We were anticipating the next week 105 degree temperature in Omaha. Inside those towers, all they had was a fan. And we have a lot of people that are elderly. I was concerned about their health. And so I did all that I could do to force the Housing Authority to provide air conditioners for people. And as a result of that effort, we have 142 people who live in Omaha Housing Authority who now have air conditioners. I think that's it. I'm just a vehicle that the Lord uses. I'm just a poor country boy. I mean, the Lord works in mysterious ways and through mysterious people. But, you know, I think that when people are committed to do something that's right, that's good, not just for yourself but for others, then there's always a way. There's always a way. And, I mean, we have a long ways to go. But we're a lot better off than we were when we got here.
It doesn't sound like it.
What's that?
It sounds like they brought y'all here and put y'all in project.
They did.
I mean, can you imagine?
I cannot.
I have a fella, just briefly.
Oh my God.
Who was homeless about, 13 years before we got here. This is the first house, first place he lived in on his own. I mean, and it was a rough transition for George to get accustomed to living in a house, in a place of his own. But thank God, he's doing much, much better now.
Yeah.
There was a lot of people who, and you have to understand what you're dealing with here. You weren't dealing with the aristocrats. You're dealing with a lot of people that have a lot of problems, who came here with a lot of problems. I mean, an awful lot of problems, you know? And even with the minimum amount of help that we've been getting, that's progress. I mean, you can see progress. It's going to take time for us to overcome, but there's progress being made, trust me. I mean, there's progress being made. It was, you should have seen what it was like when we first got here. There's progress being made. And a lot of good people are helping in that. Mm-hmm. A lot of good people.
And I just wanted to recognize that some of the Pastor Janet Banks, Denise Willoughby, Casey Moyer sitting in the front, some of the folks here in Nebraska who've been working with some of the survivors. Other questions from some students or even faculty, I guess? You tricked me in the red hair. I thought you were a student, so. Any questions?
Right there.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
I was watching Mock Chanel a couple months ago and saw a little excerpt about a person ahead of the teachers union in New Orleans who's talking about how all of the workers in the school systems, from teachers to lunch ladies, cafeteria ladies, were fired and then maybe retired on to charter schools. And that they changed it to a different system of schooling out there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I haven't seen that anywhere else in the media, so I don't know if you know about it or if you've heard about it from any of your friends in New Orleans. But also, if you haven't heard about it, do you want to go back there? And if you do, what is the most important thing that needs to be changed for you to go back there and have a good family life?
Okay, as far as the schooling system, right now, because so many of the schools were damaged so severely, the schools are opening, but it's not like your traditional schools. For example, the high schools, one high school in particular that I know of is now K through 12. Okay, so as you know, I mean, that's not your ideal school setting. I mean, I would not want my 5-year-old in the same school with an 18-year-old. Okay, and as far as me going back to New Orleans right now, no, although I would really like to go back to help the community, but until they can get like more adequate housing and a better control on the crime, I wouldn't go back right now. So I guess my answer is no. And I guess the charter schools, New Orleans public school system is, you know, no more right now. It's non-existent because of Katrina. So they have switched to charter schools right now until they can kind of rebuild the city a little bit more.
I guess Biloxi's a little different. They schools have reopened. They reopened in February. We were told after the hurricane that if you had family anywhere or know anybody anywhere that would take your child, to send them there to go to school. So for the most part, that's what most people did, was send their children away to go to school in other places. They've come back, but like they are in New Orleans, everything's K through 12. Most schools, they're still shut down. They're not even walkable right now. But for the most part, the schools have, some of them have reopened, the ones that weren't damaged so bad.
Oh.
I'm happy you asked that question. Okay, let me explain to you what happened to me. I lost my car in Katrina, and as you all know, in the state of Nebraska, you have so long to change everything over. Well, when I changed my plates over, I had to get my driver's license and everything to meet Nebraska requirements. Well, they did not tell me was that once I changed my driver's license to Nebraska, I lost my voting rights in Louisiana. Okay, after, subsequent to changing my driver's license to Nebraska, that's when I received a letter in the mail letting me know as long as I still have a Louisiana driver's license, I can vote Louisiana. So, they tricked me. I lost all of my voting rights once I got once I obtained the Nebraska driver's license. Okay. And I think that should have been something that they told us. And a lot of the people who were receiving like the food stamps and everything in Texas, it was required that they obtain, you know, that state driver's license in order to receive that particular state's, you know, benefits. So that's how they got a lot of people to change their state of residencies in order to receive that state's benefits. So they got a lot of people to change, and that's how a lot of people lost their voting rights. Okay.
Disenfranchisement of black voters is not unique to New Orleans, but in this particular case, it's heinous.
Mm-hmm.
I volunteered to work in St. Louis, where they have a notoriously wicked campaign to keep people from voting. And it has to be all of us that make a difference. You've got to call your cell phones now. A lot of times you can call long distance for the same price that you paid your regular cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
People have got to program those numbers of their elected officials in there and the president's White House number,
mm-hmm.
and call that and say, what's happening this week? What are you doing? And get them to mm-hmm. realize that all of us care, because I think that we all do feel this humongous sense of loss on your behalf.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
It is a very helpless feeling for us as well. There really is, there is a sense that if we give money to organizations like the Red Cross, that we're not going to actually benefit from that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying don't give to the Red Cross, that's not my point, because mm-hmm. they have to be ready to respond to the next hurricane.
Yeah.
But,
right.
Man, it's going to have to take the grassroots.
Why?
One more question. Any students?
May I just real quick?
Yeah, yeah.
In terms of the voting thing, and I'm reluctant to say this because I've prided myself all my life on voting. And we did have an opportunity, those of us in Omaha, to vote absentee ballot. I think maybe three people did. But me personally, I refuse to vote. I refuse to vote. Why should I vote when I have no representation? And if this doesn't teach me that I don't have any representation, I don't know what will. So I mean, voting to me, when I see a representation, I'll vote. But until then, they were the politicians. And then say they speak with a fuck tongue.
One more question. I think yeah. someone over there. Who's it?
Oh, well, my main concern is, I was wondering if, like you said, you're away from your children. I was wondering if your children are
whatever, how much school do you think that educationally, how much do you think they missed out on? All the children who were misplaced by Katrina.
Is that
directed
at me?
Yeah. Anybody.
Oh, okay. in terms of the children of Katrina, those of us who are here, the experience has had a traumatic effect on kids. And let me tell you how. I have a young kid, one of our children, who's 14 years old. And though their parents evacuated the city before the storm, he lost two of his classmates. He's lost contact with people that he's known all his life, his friends, his neighborhood, sports fans, I mean, everything. He's lost it all. And then he moved to a state where the educational system is completely different from that from which he came, not knowing anybody, having to start over, and then having been labeled an evacuee. And in some cases, a refugee. But, I mean, for the kids that I've seen, it's had a profound, all but one. We had one young man in Omaha who has a real good basketball game. He's a 10th grade. And he's making an impact there with through his sports. But for the most part, what I've heard from the children is that the system here is so different from the system that they came from. And then I think that the level of education out here is higher than that in Louisiana. Let me give you an example. I went to school in Louisiana. I did not begin to learn that I could learn how to read until I was 21 years old. Yeah, let me say that again. I did not learn that I could learn how to read until I was 21 years old. Sentenced to 104 years in the federal penitentiary. Served 12 years, 8 months, 23 days, and came out with a college degree. But while I was in the state of Louisiana, I did not know that I could even learn how to read. Another rap on that.
Well, I think we've all seen what a painful, I think difficult, experience this has been. I would encourage everyone to come up afterwards. I think we have some time. Talk with our panelists if you have any questions. Also want to recognize, I think Patrick, I think you've got another event later on tonight at 7. He has more information. And both Caroline and Pam and Ashley also have information about the Nebraska Outreach Project. So please give a big, big round of applause.
For 1 second. This is day 2 of an ongoing, what will be 4 or 5 day project that we have here with many events. I have a few cards here with posters up and things.
I'll get you a recording.
Later tonight, Lance Hill will be talking in the same room here at 7:30, right? 7:30 tonight. And he'll be talking about how race has been a part of what happened during the storm and the response and afterwards. Lance is a historian from Tulane University. He also runs the Southern Institute on Education and Research at Tulane, as well as a 27-year resident of New Orleans. So he'll be here tonight. We also have Tanya Harris, who's coming. She's the lead organizer from the Lower Ninth Ward chapter of ACORN. And just really on the front lines in the Lower Ninth Ward representing local people's rights as they're trying to get the community going again. So I encourage you, she's doing a few different things here and around the community. Tomorrow night, Adam Ossinger, the New York Times journalist who's been covering these events since the hurricane happened, will be here sharing his experience and thoughts as well. We have a panel on Friday of students and community members who've gone south to be a part of this process. I think those are some of the major things that we have going on, but we really encourage you to come out again, to spread the word about the other events as well. I just personally want to thank everybody for coming. This has been a profoundly moving panel today, and I know that you've made an impact And I hope that maybe we can, some of those that are here and those of us who are professors and others, we might be able to build a network of people to support each other in this, and maybe that could be one of the practical outcomes of that. So if anybody's interested in doing that, not just sitting in this room and hearing and being moved by it and going back to your dorm room and going on with life, but continuing that process, you can contact me, Tarek, Shauna, Oakley, who I want to acknowledge as well, the folks. And also the Public Policy Center, who really has been the lead on this particular event. And so I want to thank everybody. It's really an example of how different pieces of the puzzle, when we try to work together, we can do some good things. And so I hope that something will come out of this. So if you are interested in continuing to think about this and to be actively involved, please seek one of us out, and we can try to do something beyond this as well. But I'd just like to thank everyone again for coming. It's really been a meaningful afternoon. So thanks so much. If we could maybe give another round.
That's it.
Table here to be for the rest of the week. Please take on.